to order. This morning we have a presentation on the payment in lieu of taxes program by the DNR and the legislative auditor, and we hope to have a conversation about this program. It's new for the committee's jurisdiction. It was previously in a different budget in previous bienniums. So with that, members, we would like to hear from Bob Meyer from the Department of Natural Resources, and then we'll hear from Susan DeMone, project consultant for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, and John Yunker, Office of the Legislative Auditor. Mr. Meyer, good morning, and welcome to the Tax
Committee. Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you very much. For the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner Tom Landrieu, Department of Natural Resources. And thank you for that introduction today. The Payment in Lieu of Taxes program, as Susan will discuss here momentarily, is found in several different statutes of law. It was developed a couple decades ago to help alleviate the concerns that people were having with the state buying land and taking that property taxes off of the tax roll. So thus the name Payment in Lieu of Taxes. The reason it's in this committee this year, there was a decision amongst leadership within the House and Senate that the program would be tracked within the Tax Committee, I believe. The way the appropriation has worked in the past, or still does work right now currently, is these dollars are appropriated to the Department of Natural Resources, then we transfer them to the Department of Revenue, who actually expends the dollars. So it becomes rather complicated when you look at our budget. It has right now about $43 million per biennium more money than we actually spend because we transfer those dollars, and then Department of Revenue has about $43 million more than they actually have because they're spending this transfer. So that's what we're tracking here today in your committee now. The monies in and out are being both tracked here. So, Madam Chair, with that, I'm going to introduce Susan Damon, who is our PILT, Payment in Lieu of Taxes, coordinator. What we do in this program is we calculate or we basically pull in all of the data and send that over to Department of Revenue to issue the payment. So Susan can talk about what that data is.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Susan Damon. I'm a project consultant with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, and I will be providing the committee with a brief overview of payment in lieu of taxes. Payment in lieu of taxes, or PILT, is a form of local government aid that is made by the state. The purpose, according to Minnesota statutes, Section 477A12, is to offset expenses incurred by local governments in the support of natural resources lands. The Department of Revenue makes the primary PILT payment in July of every year, and under existing law, the payment to be made this July is calculated to be $25,190,761. The Department of Natural Resources makes an additional payment in August of every year for public hunting lands, and under existing law, the August 2011 payment is calculated to be $176,743. There are three classes of land that account for most of the PILT payments, and those are DNR-acquired natural resources land, DNR-managed other natural resources land, and county-managed other natural resources land. And I'll talk about each of these land classes briefly. The PILT payment rate for a particular parcel of land depends on its classification. Yes. The highest rate is applied to land that is classified as DNR-acquired natural resources land. And this is land that was either on the tax rolls when the DNR acquired it, or it is consolidated conservation land that is managed as a wildlife management area, scientific and natural area, state park, or state recreation area. The general rate for acquired natural resources land is 0.75% of the appraised value, or $3 per acre adjusted for inflation, whichever is greater. There is an exception to that rate for Lake Vermilion State Park and Sudan Underground Mine State Park, and that rate is 1.5% of the appraised value. The appraised value is the purchase price for the first 5 years after acquisition, And after that time, it is the county assessor's appraised value for the land. The lowest PILT rate applies to DNR-managed other land, and that rate is 37.5 cents per acre adjusted for inflation. The 37.5 rate applies to land that is permanent school trust land, permanent university trust land, and neither of these types of land were ever on the tax rolls. It also applies to county board resolution land and to consolidated conservation land that is not managed by the DNR as a WMA, SNA, state park, or state recreation area. And the final category is county-managed other natural resources land. This is tax-forfeited land, and it is managed by the property by the county for the benefit of local taxing districts. The PILT payment rate for this land type is 75 cents per acre adjusted for inflation. And finally, the allocation of PILT depends on the land type. PILT that is paid for public hunting lands is allocated as if it were a tax on the land, and it is allocated to counties, towns, and school districts. PILT that is paid for non-hunting and other lands is distributed to counties and townships according to Minnesota Statute Section 477A.14, and generally 40% of that amount goes to the county for property tax levy reductions, and the remainder is for purposes that are set forth in the statute, and that includes natural resources management and deposit in the county general revenue fund. So that concludes my presentation. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from the committee. Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, could you tell me on the hunting land, how many acres you're talking about there?
I will have to get that figure for you. I can pull it out of my briefcase, or I can get that to you later.
Mr. Meyer.
Madam Chair, just briefly, we went through a lot of different acronyms that we always use in the Environment Committee, but if I can just describe a couple of these types of lands that are there. The consolidated conservation lands are lands that the state acquired from basically the seven northwestern counties back in the 20s and 30s when they were going bankrupt, and the state took over those lands in exchange of the debt that they had there. So there's several hundred thousand acres of consolidated conservation lands up in the northwest part of the state. A WMA is a wildlife management area primarily used for hunting. Scientific and natural area, or an SNA, are lands that are described. All of these are described in Chapter 86A that are protected for their rare scientific and natural resource, what's on the ground, rare plants, trees, outcrops, or whatever. State park is pretty self-explanatory. A state recreation area is an area such as the Gilbert State Recreation Area up in northeast Minnesota, which is a off-highway vehicle park. We have several other state recreation areas that are used for mountain biking or for camping and hunting and things like that. It's kind of a mix between a park and a wildlife management area is a good way to think of it. So,
Mr. Meyer or Ms. Damon, did I say Damon. That right this time? I'm sorry about that. We have a spreadsheet that was handed out to the members, and I believe you have it as well, that shows PILT payments for fiscal 2009 to be paid in July 2010. Now, they all go to counties. Is that correct? And then if you could take us through the spreadsheet just a little bit to show how it's tracked, I would appreciate that.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I can take a stab at this, and I'll have Ms. Damon help me as well. First of all, to Senator Howe's question there, you can see the total on the public hunting acres there on the bottom of what will be the back side of this page at 426,000 acres. I believe we have a little bit more than that. Right now in the WMA system, we have 1.3 million acres, so I think the payments are more closer to that. I'll get back to you on that. But this sheet is what we use in conjunction with the Department of Revenue, where we calculate public acres, the value of those acres, the non-hunting acres, the value of that land. So basically on the top are the different land categories that we've described here that correlate to the different types of payments. Then On the other side of, you can see the land types, acreages, and values. Then the other side of this table are the payments. So for each type of these categories, public hunting values or public hunting land, the payment is calculated. I want to make sure I have the right value here. Is that three-quarters of the public hunting value is on that category, and Susan will know what that value is right off the top of her head.
Yeah. Well, it depends on the land classification. If it is acquired, it is calculated at 0.75% of the appraised value, or $3 per acre adjusted for inflation. And then there are different rates that apply to consolidated conservation lands and to LUP, which is land utilization project. That's land that's actually not owned by the DNR. It's federal land, but it is leased to the DNR. And then the DNR administered other lands get the 37.5 cent per acre adjusted for inflation rate, and county administered 75 cents per acre adjusted for inflation.
Ms. Damon or Mr. Meyer, I don't understand what the DNR administrative acres are, that second to the last column, and why we would make a payment on that. Can you explain what that is?
The DNR administered, as I indicated in the presentation, the DNR administered other lands are school trust, university lands. They are county board resolution lands, which are lands which were formerly tax forfeited, but the status was changed by county board resolution, and they've been converted to natural resources land. And then the other category is consolidated conservation land that's not managed as WMA, SNA. And I am not able to explain why it was a legislative determination that PILT would be paid on these.
It's one that I'm struggling with, because if the county boards are resolving to set aside this land, it would seem that it's not state action. And I'm not sure why the state would reimburse them for payment in lieu of taxes, unless I'm missing something. If they're acting to preserve this land, why are they not taking responsibility for the property tax impact?
Madam Chair, members, that's a good question. We administer the PILT program as required by statute. Initially it was established by the legislature. It wasn't a natural resource proposal. I think, as Ms. Damon was talking about, the DNR administrative acres also include the 2.5 million acres of permanent school trust fund lands that the department manages in benefit of the children. So these are swamps and forested lands throughout the state that we're managing for the school trust. But the legislature, I think it was the late 80s, probably when this program was first initiated, made that determination that all of these lands would be benefited from a payment for the counties. Or the counties would benefit from a payment because of the lack of development, the benefits of natural resource management, and those types of things. The timber industry, for example, Madam Chair, provides substantial economic impact to the state and millions of dollars into the general fund because of the taxes that it generates. So I think some of those considerations were taken into effect when that determination might have been made.
Are the reimbursement rates set in statute?
That is correct, Madam Chair. The rates that I discussed are statutory rates adjusted, and the current payments, there's also an inflation index that is in statute.
That was my question, my second question. Thank you for answering that. Other questions? Senator Bach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Meyer, I was in South Dakota hunting pheasants last fall, and I was reading through their game regulations, their booklet like we have. And I noticed in there, there was a reference in there. It said hunting licenses pay for property taxes on public land. And I'm just wondering, here in Minnesota, all of our WMA lands, the payment in lieu of tax payment there is made by the general fund. Why wouldn't it be the right policy on the WMA land that's acquired for specifically for hunting. We don't allow other, really other uses of it. Why wouldn't we have the Game and Fish Fund, for example, pay the PILT payment on that land that's purchased just for hunting purposes, and rather than an obligation of the general fund? And isn't there some precedence for that? Isn't the way that the way it used at some point in time it was? And how much is that WMA PILT number? Do we know that?
Mr. Meyer.
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, on the back of, and I wish there was page numbers on this, but on the back side of this table again, under the payments column, you'll see under public hunting payment, right now it's $4.9 million approximately being used to attribute it to those hunting lands that are acquired. You are correct that payment on hunting lands at one point did come out of the Game and Fish Fund, but that was changed probably almost 20 years ago that it would come out, or 20 or more years ago. I couldn't find out the exact date that that was changed, but it was a determination made that those funds should come out of the general fund. The Game and Fish Fund right now cannot support taking over the payment in lieu of taxes program. You and I have had conversations about this, but the department is seeking a fee increase on the hunting and fishing licenses that some people do or do not support. But if we were going to go down that road, we would have to seriously consider that proposal once again. The stakeholders in the state, the sportsmen and women, are understanding and, for the most part, supportive of those increases because of the hunting and fishing that they want and expect within the state. But to put this burden back on the Game and Fish Fund would just exasperate that fund imbalance problem.
Senator Bach.
Well, Madam Chair, let me help the committee a little bit. What happened was the state, by shifting that payment to the general fund, was able to leverage additional federal money. There are federal accounts that come to Minnesota. There's two different accounts. Mr. Meyer knows the names of them. But it's by shifting the obligation to the state general fund, we're able to leverage additional federal money. What currently has happened because of the legacy fund and the lottery in lieu, the sales tax on lottery tickets that now also goes to the DNR, for those of you that don't know, the sales tax on lottery tickets goes to the DNR. Because of those actions, there no longer is a need for this PILT payment to be paid out of the general fund any longer. It could easily be shifted back to the Game and Fish Fund where it previously was. That's the real reason it was shifted, to leverage additional federal money. That's not necessary any longer to leverage the federal money. Just wanted to make the committee aware of that.
Senator Bach, are there still federal funds that we're getting, but they're not required to be matched? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying, Madam Chair, there's enough other general fund spending, to adequate general fund spending, to leverage the maximum of federal money we can achieve. But Mr. Meyer can speak to that.
Mr. Meyer?
Madam Chair, members, the funds that Senator Bach are referring to are excise taxes that are charged at the federal level on all sporting goods equipment, basically guns, ammunition, fishing equipment, that are used for those types of activities. It's the Wallop, Perot, and Pittman-Robertson dollars that the department does leverage. And Senator Bach is correct. I believe currently we're maximizing the amount of money we can receive back in those accounts. And I do have that information with me, but not readily available. It is multi-millions of dollars that the state is benefiting from those federal dollars for our hunting and fishing heritage programs.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, you had a question about the county administrator's land. There's three county land commissioners here that probably could help you answer that. I know Mr. Cox is from my home county and probably could answer that question about the county-administered lands, if you would like.
Commissioner, would you like to join us? Can you state your name for the record, sir?
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Bruce Cox. I'm the Clearwater County Land Commissioner. I also serve as legislative chair for the Minnesota Association of County Land Commissioners. We manage 2.8 million acres of tax forfeited land in northern Minnesota.
Thank you for joining us today. So my question originally was about the county administration lands, or DNR administrative acres. I don't understand if the county is making those decisions why the DNR is administering the lands. I mean, I get why they would, but why are we also making a payment if it's a choice made by the county?
Well, on the DNR administered acres, that's just a portion of those acres are those county resolution lands. That also includes the state school trust fund lands. Those resolution lands, I'm not clear on the history of that and how that fits into the whole acreage thing. I'm sorry, I just don't have the background in front of me right now.
Thank you. Senator Scoy, other questions?
No, I was just handed a note that they thought they could provide information to you, so I was bringing that to your attention.
Thank you. Members, other questions? Mr. Meyer, other comments? Otherwise, we will hear from the Office of the Legislative Auditor regarding his or their office's review of the PILT payments.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Younger, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm John Younger from the Legislative Auditor's Office. I'm just trying to get the slideshow up for you.
We do have the slides in front of us, if that helps.
Okay. I'm going to talk today about a part of a report that we issued last March, and it was a report on natural resource land, and one of the topics that was covered in the report was payments in lieu of taxes, and there's an entire chapter in that report about PILT. I'm first going to give you a brief overview of what the findings of the report were regarding PILT, and then I'll go through some of the background and get into those findings in a little more detail. I think the main conclusion here is that it's really hard. We were asked to take a look at the adequacy of PILT payments. Are they too high? Are they too low? Are they about right? That's a really difficult question to answer. And part of the reason for that is there's not much guidance in statutes as to what the purpose of PILT is. The fiscal impacts, I mean, if what PILT is designed to do is to address the fiscal impacts of state land on local governments, those fiscal impacts are very difficult to measure. There are a lot of possible fiscal impacts, and it's very difficult to say what the right amount should be for PILT. We did try to do a statistical analysis and look at whether higher levels of public land ownership are associated with higher levels of fiscal stress for counties. We couldn't do this for townships or school districts. We could only do it for counties given the data. So what you're looking for there is higher public land ownership associated with, say, higher tax rates. And we could find no evidence that public land ownership was related to higher levels of fiscal stress for counties. As I'm going to talk about later, that doesn't mean that you can take away the PILT. That just means that given what PILT is, there's no evidence that land ownership is having an impact. So it's kind of an indication that PILT levels are adequate. It doesn't address whether they're more than adequate or less than adequate. It basically says they're about adequate. That doesn't mean that for a particular county that is always the case or for a particular situation, but overall, in general, PILT is probably providing adequate compensation. We also...
Mr. Younger, doesn't what you just said disagree with the last point on your slide, which says that most counties appear to receive more PILT than is necessary to offset the property tax revenue lost?
Well, there's a little bit of a contradiction. I mean, but when you're doing, Madam Chair, when you're doing a statistical analysis, there might be things that you can't capture in that analysis that are causing you to reach the conclusion you're reaching. So I just wanted to give you the full array of evidence here that we were able to come up with. And when we tried to do statistical analyses, we could not find any evidence that PILT was that there was a problem with PILT payments. I should say that there were some statistical runs, some statistical regressions that suggested that PILT might be more than adequate. So that would seem to be consistent with the last bullet.
But
we couldn't reach that conclusion on an overall basis. It wasn't as strong a statistical result as you would think, given the last bullet.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With the last bullet, so I think, you know, if the average PILT payment is $2 an acre or whatever it is, the property tax payment on that land would certainly have been more than that, I would have thought. So how could we arrive at that conclusion?
Mr. Yonker.
Madam Chair and Representative, Senator Skoy, this last bullet applies only to acquired non-hunting land, and the payment there is the highest payment. It's the $5.11 at the time we did the study, or 0.75% of the property value. So this does not apply to the kind of land that you were just talking about, the DNR administered land.
And the percentage of land that is the acquired is considerably, or certainly the smallest percentage, maybe like 15 or 20% of the total lands.
Mr. Yonker.
Madam Chair and Senator Skoy, I would have to take a look at those numbers, but certainly the acquired land is a more significant portion of the payments because it's receiving larger payments.
But, Senator Madam
Skoy.
Chair, of the acres, I think I've got some numbers here. I think there's 1,400,000 of acquired land and 7 million of the other. So you don't want to draw conclusions on all 9 million acres about what 15% of them are doing. And that's what I would be concerned about as I read that last bullet.
Madam Chair, I think it's fair to say that last bullet only applies to the acquired non-hunting lands, and it does not apply to the other lands.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bach.
Well, Madam Chair, to that point, and Mr. Yonker, I think what's missing, I mean, I think of DNR acquired land, and I think of the 6 state parks along the north shore of Lake Superior. That's all DNR acquired land. What counties give up when the DNR acquires land on the North Shore for a state park is the future development opportunity of that land. I mean, that land is not going to stay undeveloped indefinitely, but when it becomes a state park or other state acquired property, those development rights are lost forever. So the future tax capacity that could get built when a new resort is built there or new multi-million dollar homes are built there all go away. So I think that's what was missing relative to the DNR acquired land, is nobody took anything into consideration about, well, what was the potential tax capacity of this when the land became developed. That's the discussion I had with Governor Plenty relative to the Vermilion State Park. Highly developable, high value, would have been developed into a multi-million dollar home tract, and by making that a park, the county gave up all the future development opportunity of that. So it's about more than just the value of the raw land. I think that's what's kind of been missing from the discussion relative to the acquired land.
Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, I think the last bullet point is pretty self-explanatory. It says right on there, the last line, when DNR acquires non-hunting land. I mean, it's pretty specific to Senator Skoy's point that it does specifically spell it out, but I also point out that when you'd probably also have to take into account the resources that a county needs to provide to land that's not going to be developed or what have you, and it could in fact be a significant driver of revenue in the future for people coming to hunt, coming to visit the park, coming to do those things. So there is a balance there that I think we'd have to weigh on everything, but you do also have to look at the resources that go forward. Just like a county that has significant farmland, what kind of resources have to go into that? So I think there is an offset there.
Senator Howe, I agree with you. When Senator Bach talks about what you're giving up for the potential development of the land, there certainly are other economic development opportunities because now you've got a park that is a regional attraction.
Madam Chair, I don't dispute that. I don't dispute that at all. But, I mean, let's use Mayo Clinic, for example, okay, when the Center and Syndromes District, when the Mayo Clinic expands, that drives economic activity in Rochester, but Olmsted County gets additional property tax revenue when that happens. So, and when the park is developed, there's not additional tax capacity that happens, unlike other developments that add tax capacity.
Senator Howe.
I would have to check on that. I don't know if Senator St. John, Madam Chair, could speak to that. I don't know what the tax consequences are for Mayo. I'm not sure how much property taxes do they pay. I thought they had some tax-exempt status there, too.
No, Madam Chair, they pay a lot of property tax. By far the largest
millions
in Rochester.
Okay.
Millions.
Millions.
Okay. All right.
Well, I do think you have to look at the give and take here, because there's some of both. You're giving up some opportunities, but you're gaining some opportunities. It may not be a one-for-one equivalent, but you're certainly making a choice at a local level about what to do with your natural resources. And for that part, I'm not convinced that the state has a major responsibility to step in and offset the consequences of that choice the degree that we do.
Well, Madam Chair, just let me use Vermilion as the example again, because that's the most recent one. The little township of Brighting Township, with their own little police department, is going to have an incredible new burden placed on the local law enforcement when this state park opens. And that comes at a real cost, I mean, to the township. I mean, to somehow say that the township's not entitled to some additional revenue from the state for all the costs that they're going to incur, I think people need to think about that, because there certainly are going to be significant additional costs in managing traffic and additional accidents and whatever kind of mischievous behavior that goes on, calls in the middle of the night where people in parks sometimes are having a really good time. There's going to be additional costs involved. And I think the state has some obligation when we develop those kind of properties to help the local government unit out, cover them costs, so it doesn't just fall on the property taxpayers in that township.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And back to my original point is that the vast majority of the PILT land payment is significantly less than the property tax payment would be if the land was privately held. It might be on the DNR-acquired hunting land. That's a relatively small part. The payment is comparable if you don't take into account the development rights.
Senator Skoy, do you think there would be a reason for an adjustment on the reimbursement rates that are indexed for inflation when the corresponding property values are dropping in the private economy?
Well, Madam Chair, if they were where the private economy was, that might be a point to be made, but they've never equaled that in the majority of the acres.
Right, but proportionately, Senator Skoy, if that's the whole argument, is they're supposedly less than what you would raise with the property tax, that proportionality is adjusting as the private market values go down and we index these reimbursement rates up automatically.
And the other thing, Madam Chair, that you should think about, while home values and lot values have declined significantly in the rural areas, I think a lot of this open land, ag land, has not seen that kind of decline.
Madam Chair.
Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering if the auditor might speak to, and maybe you'll get to this in your presentation, about what incentive or what checks and balance the DNR has then. If this is coming out of the general fund, the agency that decides that they're going to take, to Senator Skoy's point, land off the tax roll, how is it going to affect the agency's budget if it's just going to end up being picked up by the general fund?
Senator Howe, to your point, when we had our report of the fastest growing expenditures in the state's budget, PILT payments were among the top, the quickest growing as a percentage of our budget. So it is a fair point. I'm hoping Mr. Yonker will get to that. Mr. Yonker, before you take up your presentation again, I just want to make an announcement that we received note from Senator Nelson's office that she would like to pull the bill that we were going to hear on mining taxes today, so that will not Senate File 774, and she's going to reschedule that for another day. So for those of you that were here to testify about that, we want to just make sure that you're aware that she's taking that off. We are still going to have the mining tax overview, however. Mr. Yonker, sorry for the interruptions, if you'd like to proceed.
Madam Chair, I think it just makes the first point on this slide that there's not much agreement about what the purpose of HILT is. And that makes it very difficult to evaluate. I would say that what Senator Bach brings up is kind of a special case. What would be the development potential of land? And when we looked at this, we're trying to look at, you know, the way land, for the most part, the way most land is used in the state. But there are special cases where there's development potential of the land, and that's not the way it's taxed necessarily currently when DNR acquires it. So, you know, you will have some special cases that might deserve some special attention. I'm going to skip through some of these early slides because I think a lot of this DNR covered in their presentation. But about one-sixth of the state is natural resource land. Two-thirds of this is managed by DNR. About a third of it is the tax-forfeited land you heard about that counties manage, and it's held in trust by the state for counties. I just want to emphasize one point here on this slide that most of the PILT is distributed to counties and townships. But when it comes to the acquired hunting lands, it's governed by an older law, and it's distributed to counties, townships, and school districts. And that's going to come up later, and that's a very important consideration when you're talking about is PILT too high or too low, or what does it cover? Just kind of a refresher here that there's kind of three different payment rates. These were the 2009 payment rates. DNR gave you the more updated. They're not much different. But the acquired land gets the greater of two figures in a county, gets either, I think it's now 513 an acre or 0.75% of the appraised value. And the DNR administered land, which is your trust fund land and certain other consolidated conservation land, gets the lowest payment. And then the tax forfeited land gets a payment that's about double the payment for other DNR administered land. We looked at, you know, how PILT payments changed over time. And truly, PILT payments did not keep up with inflation from 1980 to the year 2000. They lagged well behind inflation. And what's happened, and Madam Chair, you referred to PILT being one of the fastest growing expenditures. I think that's a particular calculation. But in looking at it since 2000, it has been growing quite fast. From 2000 to 2009, it tripled. And the main reason it tripled was because the legislature made some changes to the PILT law, and there was tremendous growth in land values. And so when you incorporated a land value concept for acquired land and land values grew significantly, the PILT payments went up a lot. So if you looked at 2009 PILT per acre, how did it compare to 1980 when adjusted for inflation? It was 30% higher. So we had not kept up with inflation through to 2000, but during the last decade, we exceeded the rate of inflation and caught up for where we were. Having said that, however, PILT for some counties has not kept up with inflation over this longer period because those counties primarily contain non-acquired land. That's the land that's DNR other administered land or the county tax forfeited land, and that land has not, over this longer period, kept up with inflation. You
that
do.
Point, Senator, I'm sorry, Senator Skoy had a question on that.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I think Mr. Yonkers just made the point that I was going to make is when you look at the inflation that's occurring in the payment in lieu, it is mostly in the acquired lands area, in the non-acquired. Or the other, the larger, where the larger number of acres are, isn't growing at near as fast a rate. I don't remember the page, but there's a graph in the legislative auditor's report that demonstrates that quite effectively. And I think testifier also said that that would be the reason that some counties' payment in lieu isn't keeping up and others are, basing upon the mix of whether they have a lot of acquired land or not.
you. Mr. Younger.
Madam Chair, I just would say that there is an inflation factor, as Ms. Damon mentioned, for those types of land since the year 2000. But if you look at that longer period, 1980 to 2009, there was no inflation factor for 20 years. So looking over the longer period, that type of land that Senator Scoy references did not keep up with inflation.
Mr. Younger, are you saying, have I heard you correctly, that the legislative changes in 2000 tied the payments to land values, or has that always been a connection in our payment system?
Madam Chair, there was I think that was the beginning, it's been a year since I presented this report in detail. So I think that was the beginning of the inflation adjustment, not only for the non-acquired types of land, but also the inflation, the tying of acquired land payments to the value of land.
Thank you.
So, Madam Chair, I'm going to go through these findings in a little more detail that we just talked about. And as I mentioned, there really are no criteria in statute or not much guidance as to what the purpose of PILT. So we have a lot of debate over whether what PILT is for and whether it's adequate or not. But I think when it comes down to it, PILT is probably intended to offset the fiscal impacts of state land ownership on local government. So what might some of those fiscal impacts be? Well, if you're talking about acquired land, when DNR acquires it, it's taken off the tax rolls. So you lose property tax revenue, and you gain PILT payments. So one question there would be, how do the PILT payments compare to the lost property tax revenues? There are other possible fiscal impacts, however. One of those could be that when DNR acquires land, it affects property values in and around that acquisition site. Does it increase those values or does it decrease those values? I don't think there's a general answer that can be provided. I know of one county that's looked at this and they found that it increased values. That was Roseau County. I'm not aware that any other county has looked at this specifically as to whether their state land, how that affects values adjacent to the state land. Another big area where there is a potential fiscal impact is if there's state land, it could affect the costs of providing local government services. If you have a very active state park, a very active DNR site where there are a lot of people visiting, that could impact road costs. It could impact other local government costs of law enforcement. But I think you also have to keep in mind that some DNR land does not have a lot of active visitors. It's a lot of DNR land is forested land. It has some hunters, perhaps. But the real consideration there is when DNR acquires the land or owns the land, is that adding to the costs or making the costs less? So that would really vary from site to site, from parcel to parcel. Another consideration is that when DNR acquires land, that can trigger increased aid payments to local governments. It would increase has a potential for increasing aid payments to counties through county program aid, also through LGA to cities. And in particular, it would increase payments to local school districts because of the way the school aid formula is set up. Another consideration is that from tax forfeited or consolidated conservation lands, there are some shared revenue payments. So those lands, when they can be managed for timber or other products, there are revenues generated, and state law requires either for tax forfeited, those lands do go to the counties because they're managing that, and then they distribute them on down to other jurisdictions. But for consolidated conservation land requires DNR to pass on some of those proceeds to local governments. Finally, the acquisition or the holding of land by the state, by DNR, can have economic impacts. It could increase tourism, and that could have an indirect effect on local governments and their finances. On the other hand, if DNR is acquiring prime agricultural land, that could take land away from agricultural production and have an economic effect on that local area that's negative. So there are a lot of different effects. They can go either way in some cases, and there's really not enough data out there and not enough time in a lifetime to really evaluate and look at all the different parcels out there and what their fiscal impacts are on local governments. So as I said, we looked at the statistical relationship between public land ownership and fiscal stress in counties. We for acquired land only, we compared PILT to estimated property taxes lost. That's only one of the possible fiscal impacts on local governments from DNR land acquisition, but it's the one that's probably the most relevant and the most important. And we also look to some extent at how DNR land acquisitions impact other state aids that are paid to local governments. And I'm going to talk primarily about the first two and maybe indirectly about the last one today. As I mentioned earlier, we were able to look at how public land ownership affects fiscal stress in counties, and we could find no statistical relationship. There were some regressions, some analyses that suggested that land ownership, greater land ownership, was related to less fiscal stress. But, you know, in a statistical analysis, you're kind of looking for, in this respect, looking for a relationship with land ownership, and there could be a lot of other factors that are causing fiscal stress, and this one's only a very small factor and doesn't show up as being significant. The results basically suggest that there's no evidence that PILT is, for counties in general, is inadequate. So the other thing we did was to look at PILT and how PILT compares to the property taxes lost when DNR acquires land. Again, this only applies to acquired land. It doesn't apply to the other types of land, and this particular slide only applies to the acquired non-hunting land. Going back to what I said earlier, PILT for acquired non-hunting land is paid to counties and towns, so the appropriate comparison is how does PILT compare to county-town taxes that were raised on that land prior to its acquisition. And what we found was that on average, and this is an average of averages, we averaged within a county, we averaged across counties in Minnesota, PILT for newly acquired lands, at least in the first year, is on average 64% higher than county town taxes. But you have to recognize that state land, unlike private land, is only reappraised every 5 years. So when that land first comes in to DNR land ownership, it would be on average, not in every county, not in every township, not everywhere, but on average throughout the state, 64% higher than the taxes. But that could change in subsequent years because the next year, let's say, the DNR land is not reappraised. So it's at the same value. But if it had been continued in private hands, it could have increased or decreased in value, depending on what the assessor did. And also tax rates and tax levies could have changed. So the difference could change over time until you have the next reappraisal of DNR land. So when I talk about the 64%, I'm talking about the first year after its acquisition, and what happens after that could change some depending on these other factors. In looking at PILT versus county town taxes for acquired non-hunting land, what we found was that the counties were the main beneficiary of this difference between PILT and taxes. Remember, counties and towns get the PILT, townships are only getting about 2.5% of the PILT on average. Town taxes are about 20% of the combined county-town tax rate. So townships are really getting the short end of the stick here, and the counties are benefiting from that. And the main reason it goes back to when the laws were changed to put in the inflation factors, the township share was not, there wasn't an inflation factor built in for the township share. So it's still getting a certain amount that's not been adjusted for inflation like the other PILT has. We also looked, and this was after we issued the report, we also looked at acquired hunting land. Again, it's acquired land. It's not the other types of land that is not acquired. Here, PILT is paid to counties, towns, and school districts. And here, because you've got the school district taxes, the PILT is only 27% on average higher than county, town, and school taxes. And the same qualifications I said about that, about what happens after the first year that pertain to the hunting land, non-hunting land apply to the hunting land. One difference here is that state law says the county, townships, and school districts receive this PILT in proportion to their respective tax rates. So you don't have the distributional issue you have with acquired non-hunting land where the townships aren't getting their fair share. They're getting the share in proportion to their tax rates. One thing this comparison does not do is it does not adjust for the fact that when the land is acquired and the local school district is losing some tax revenue, some of that is made up for in increased state aids. So even though we're saying it's only 27% higher, and that's less than the 64%, this is a little deceiving because the school district is getting some state aids to some extent to replace some of those lost school taxes. So they get the PILT and they get the school education aids to replace some of the taxes lost. I think all of this raises some issues that are a little hard to resolve, but the issues are, is PILT for acquired non-hunting lands too high? Should townships get a greater share of PILT for acquired non-hunting lands? And I'm going to come to another slide about the school districts, but the issue there would be, should school districts continue to receive PILT for acquired hunting lands? Is there a reason to continue those PILT payments? And then finally, should cities be eligible for PILT if the state land is in a city and not a township? The way state law currently reads, a city's not eligible for PILT. But if the property that DNR has is in a city, the city is the one incurring the costs, and there's one prime example of that in a park along the St. Croix where a city is incurring some significant costs but doesn't receive the PILT. It's all going to the county. The question I want to raise here is, how are school districts affected by state land purchases? And I would say that for the most part, school district revenues are not affected because state aid offsets the loss of taxes from the purchased property. You could go even farther and say that the basic foundation aid that school districts get has nothing to do with taxes. It's all provided by the state. But then there are other aids that are paid through a combination of state aid and taxes, and they're equalized so that if there are less taxes, there's more state aid paid. There are two exceptions to that that are notable. One is taxes that school districts raise for debt service levies. And that's a very complicated area, and I think all I can say in summarizing that is that it's possible if DNR buys some land for the tax rates for debt service levies to increase. It's also possible they might not, depending on certain characteristics of the school district, but they could increase And so there could be a burden on school district taxpayers from a land purchase. The other area is tax rates for operating referendum levies. They could be affected if DNR is purchasing certain ag homestead property, because that ag homestead property, the house, the garage, and 1 acre of land, does pay the operating referendum levies. But there's other land that DNR could be acquiring, other ag homestead land, ag non-homestead land, non-commercial seasonal recreational property. All of that does not pay the operation. Those types of properties do not pay taxes for operating levy purposes, so they would be not affected. They would not be affected by DNR land purchases. So I think an argument could be made overall that while there are some exceptions, that perhaps school districts don't need these or shouldn't get these PILT payments for hunting lands. And that's the only place where they get the PILT payments. For all other types, acquired hunting lands, for all other types of land, school districts do not get PILT payments. So, Madam Chair, that concludes my presentation, and I'd be glad to answer any questions that the committee has.
Thank you. In light of your presentation, I know we have to move on to the mining taxes, but I'm hoping if Ms. Damon is still here, and Mr. Meyer, oh, there she is. Ms. Damon, can I ask you a question? And members, there is a handout in your packet that we hadn't reviewed, prepared by Ms. Damon, and that is on the history of PILT payments 1980 to 2010. With the estimates 2011 through 2015. And you prepared this sheet, Ms. Damon? This shows the huge growth in this program from 1980 all the way to the projected payments that will be due in 2015 and 16, and the growth even beyond. So even if we fully funded this year, we would have growth in this program again in the next biennium. So it is something to keep an eye on. Ms. Damon, my question for you was the tax forfeited properties, say a property owner in Hennepin County forfeits for inability to pay the taxes due on the property, that goes into the PILT payment program. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I would have to get back to you on that. I believe it would depend on whether the land is natural resources land. I will provide you an answer to that.
I would appreciate that. And then if you could, which category do those lands fall into here? We've got lots of, I guess it would depend on whether there's hunting on the land or not, but if you could give us some kind of idea how many acres are in the program because of tax forfeiture and which of these categories would include those payments.
Okay.
I would appreciate that. Thank you. And one of the land commissioners may have an answer on that. Is that Mr. Cox, Commissioner Cox, would you like to answer that question? And then if we could have, as he's coming to the table, we do want to hear the mining taxes overview. And so maybe Mr. Wagstrom, Bob Wagstrom from the Department of Revenue, could prepare his presentation. Commissioner Cox.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If a piece of property forfeits for nonpayment of taxes, that piece of property is considered by the county board as conservation or non-conservation land. If it's conservation land, it's retained and would be eligible for PILT as long as it's not platted land or land within a city structure. Okay, so conservation land then is part of the PILT payment. Currently, there's approximately 2.8 million acres of state-deeded land held in trust for the taxing district, referred to as tax-forfeited land.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Mr. Wagstrom, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Good to have you here this morning. Whenever you're ready, sir.
I'm going to ask her to prepare the chart.
Madam Chair, my name is Bob Wagstrom. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Revenue, Special Taxes Division. I work with the Minerals Office up in Eveleth, Minnesota. Mineral taxes our office works with. We work with the occupation tax. We work with the taconite production tax. We work with an unmined taconite tax. There's an ad valorem tax on natural ore. And there is a net proceeds tax for non-ferrous projects. First one I'm going to talk about, I don't work with, but another person does. It's the occupation tax. It was enacted by the 1921 legislature. It preceded state income tax laws by 12 years. It is part of the state constitution. And it exempts the income tax, or the occupation tax is in lieu of regular corporate income tax. Okay, I got that part. It's based on a calendar year on the mine value of production, not the actual sales. The mine value is the value of the ore or the taconite at the mine. It's calculated by calculating a specific price by the tons produced and the iron analysis. It's non-unitary, so all transfers of ore are considered Minnesota sales. The rate is 2.4% of the taxable value. They allow certain deductions up to the point of where they actually make the pellets. Once it comes out of the pellet plant, they no longer can take any deductions. Percentage depletion is allowed as a deduction. And the money from that, all of the money goes to the general fund. 10% is used for the University of Minnesota. 40% goes to the elementary and secondary schools. And the remainder goes into the general fund. Approximately $350,000 was collected on 2009 production, and approximately $15 million is projected for this year. The big reason is in 2009, taconite production was less than half of what it had been in previous years. So they have all their fixed costs, so they collected that much less money. The tax I mainly work with is the taconite production tax. It's based on the pellets, direct reduced iron product or concentrate, whichever is produced and they are actually selling. Last year, for production, the tax was $2.38 a ton. If they make DRI product, there is a little escalation for any 1%. It's 3 cents for any 1% that the DRI is above 72%. A regular taconite pellet or concentrates are normally about 65% iron. So they put this escalator at the DRI, they eventually want to get up to between 95 and 98% iron. The tax is escalated, and it's based on the change from the fourth quarter of the second previous year to the current or the previous year of the gross domestic product implicit price deflator. It's produced by the U.S. Department of Commerce. A taxable ton, which is what it's based on, is actually the 3-year average production of what they produced. The taxes in long tons, which is 2,240 pounds instead of a short ton, which is 2,000. And we allow the mines to subtract out the moisture and any flux additives like limestone they add that help it in the blast furnace. The reason we allow the moisture to be deducted is we had companies that did not want to put water on their pellet because they didn't want to pay the production tax, but when they shipped it down to the docks, the PCA was fining them for dust. So they were going to pay it either way, so we allowed them administratively and to subtract the moisture from the pellets. And there's usually between 0 and 2% moisture in a pellet. We only tax the product once. There are occasions where a producer will produce concentrate and may sell it to another taconite facility. In fact, one of them now that is making direct reduced iron is buying concentrate from two of the other facilities. So we do not charge those facilities the production tax. We'll just charge the final producer. And the main thing is the taconite production tax is paid in lieu of property taxes. So what the county does is they will exempt the active mining areas, the buildings, and within a certain distance of the facility. And that is an actual number. $79,138,000 will be distributed this calendar year based on the last 3 years' production. That also includes a $6.7 million state appropriation, that's equivalent of 22 cents a ton. Who pays the tax? There are currently 8 facilities that are subject to the tax. We receive production reports February 1st. We calculate the tax and the distributions and have a 2-week turnaround and tell the companies where to send the money. And the reason we tell them where to send the money is the money is distributed to recipients in various counties, and the company does not know where, exactly the split. So we tell them which counties to send the money to. They may make 2 payments. One is on February 24th. They pay half of it, and the second half they pay on August 24th. There is another facility. Esser Steel is building a new plant by the city of Nashwauk, and they will be subject to the tax when it becomes operational in a few years. I was just going to go over that state appropriation as I've been asked questions about this. It's 22 cents a ton. It comes from the general fund, and it is added to the taconite receipts and made available for distributions. It was $6.7 million for this year. The state pays at the same time the mining companies do, and it is not designated for any specific funds. Once it gets added to the mining company receipts, I have no clue where it goes. It just goes through the process. And this is where it goes. The money gets distributed amongst recipients within the taconite assistance area. And I believe in the handouts, I did have a map of the assistance area. It got distributed to 103 different cities and townships, 15 different schools, 6 counties. It goes for taconite property tax relief. Some of the money goes to Iron Range Resources. Some of it goes for the Taconite Economic Development Fund, which is a rebate to the mining companies that they need to use for reinvesting in their plant. There's a producer grant and loan fund, and there's a few other funds that are available. Here is the map of the Taconite Assistance Area, and essentially that is created... back in 1977, a school district had to have a mine, a taconite plant, or a taconite power plant in their school district. Or back in 1941, a school district had to have a municipality that had a certain percentage of natural iron ore valuation in their community.
That's the taconite referred to.
And this is also where Iron Range Resources is allowed to spend their money, that map. Money going into most of the funds is calculated using a cents per ton times a company's taxable valuation or taxable tonnage. Some of the funds are guaranteed at certain levels. Based on which fund it is, they have different percentages. The details of that guarantee are in the mining tax guide, which I believe you all received. There are several city and township funds. There's 4.5 cents that goes to where it's mined or processed. Half of it goes to the cities where it's mined, half to the processing. There's a mining effects fund, which if a community is within 3 miles of an active mining area, they they're included. They have to use half that money for infrastructure. The other half, they have to use cooperative projects with their surrounding communities. There's a 3-cent township fund that was added. There's a taconite railroad. That is a fixed amount. There used to be a taconite railroad tax, and when they abolished that tax, they grandfathered those payments into the taconite production tax. And then there is a municipal aid account, which all of the companies kick into, and it's a pooled account, and the money is redistributed based on levies, valuations, and populations. Money goes to school districts. There's a 15-cent fund that is based on enrollment and tax capacities. There's a 3.43-cent fund, which is distributed like the city fund is, based on mining or concentrating. There is a building maintenance fund for some schools that helps out the schools are getting older up there, and so this helps them out. Some schools get a taconite railroad money. There's a taconite referendum fund that the schools get $175 per pupil unit minus a 1.8% of their net tax capacity. Some money goes for school bond payments to some of the taconite districts up there. Three of the funds listed here, it's used for taconite levy replacement. There's a calculation I get from the Department of Education. If a school doesn't have enough, they don't receive enough money from the funds to cover their levy replacement. They don't really have a way to recover it. So the other school districts that have excess will share. If there's not enough money in those three funds to cover all the levy replacement, money is transferred from the taconite property tax relief account to cover the shortfall. And after all the redistributions are made, if there was excess to any one school district, that money goes to the cities and townships within the district that have mining and concentrating. There's also a couple of county funds. 15.5 cents that goes to the counties, and again, it's based on mining or location, plant location. There's a road and bridge fund that's done 50-50, again, based on mining or plant location. They also get a little taconite railroad money. There is a taconite property tax relief account. Last year, approximately $11.5 million was paid out of it. We also, in the past 2 years, have had because mining production was so low, we had to, there wasn't enough money to those three school funds to cover the levy replacements, so we had to withdraw $502,000 in 2010, and this year it's $807,000. Next year we should have a little bit extra. Iron Range Resources received some money. There is a 6-cent fund. There is a fixed amount, and I believe that, again, was kind of an old taconite railroad. I've worked here 27 years, and that number has been there since I started. There are some educational revenue bonds that Iron Range Resources has. Now, if I remember right, they made some distributions to various school districts, and I think... they were able to get a better rate by going through Iron Range Resources than the individual schools. There's a higher education account that receives a nickel a ton. There is the Taconite Environmental Protection Fund. There's the Douglas J. Johnson Economic Protection Fund. And there's also a Producer Grant and Loan Fund. Just a brief thing on the Economic Development Fund. I already went over that with the rebate. That fund is the equivalent of 30.1 cents a ton. But there is criteria that says if the mines in total don't produce 30 million tons, it doesn't apply. That happened in 2009. And then there's a few other funds. There's Range Association Municipality Schools gets like 3/10 of a cent per ton. U.S. Hockey Hall of Fame got like 2/10 of a cent per ton. This is the last year they're receiving that. And in these past slides, if there was a slide, if there was a fund that had an asterisk, those are escalated at the same rate as the taxes. It's kind of hard to read, but you have a copy in your handouts. This is where the production tax is going calendar year 2011. Those are all the various funds that it goes to. And these cents per ton might not equal the numbers that are in statute because these cents per ton are after these guarantees are applied. There's also a unmined taconite tax. It's based on 40-acre parcels of land. And essentially, if you are within the Mesabi Iron Formation and you don't mine 1,000 tons from it, you pay this tax. We calculate on whether the acreage is economic or uneconomic, and we put just a real small value on it at either $500 an acre if it's economic, or $25 an acre if it's uneconomic. On there, and oops, I can't remember how to go back. But there is a maximum tax of $15 an acre. And when this tax was created, the $500, you know, essentially, depending which community you're in, does equal the $15 per acre maximum. There's property taxes on unmined natural iron ore that's in the ground. It's exempt if it's also in proper or taconite production tax land. We go through, calculate a present worth of the property, and if it's below our minimum values, we use a minimum value. And they multiply that times the local tax rates to get a tax. There's also a net proceeds tax. It's somewhat similar to the occupation tax, except there's a few less different deductions. And the distribution is different than the occupation tax. It's 2% of the net proceeds. This just says that they use arm length sales, gives an idea of various deductions. And currently, there is no taxpayer of net proceeds. There are some that hopefully within 2 years, there may be some taxpayers like Polymet or Duluth Metals. There's one operation that is they're looking at down near Crosby Ironton. They're looking at mining manganese. They'd be subject to it. Net proceeds distributions. If it's mined or extracted in the taconite assistance area, which was that map I put up earlier, 5% goes to cities and towns, 10% to municipal aid account, 10% to schools, 20% to a couple of school funds. It's essentially the same funds that taconite production tax goes into, but there are various percentages. And I'll just go through those real quick. And if it's outside of the taconite assistance area, then the entire amount goes to the general fund. And I decided to leave time for questions because I know it's kind of a quick run through.
Questions from the members.
And most of this is covered in the mining tax guide. We've been putting that out. So if anybody does have any more questions, myself or Norma Krogris, who works with the other taxes, it's in the back of the presentation or in the tax guide.
Yeah. Just now.
Thank you very much, Mr. Wagstrom. Members, Senator Nelson has asked us to remove the bill on the agenda for today. So let me just quickly go over the agenda for tomorrow and Thursday. Tomorrow's agenda, we will hear Senator Chamberlain's sales tax on motor vehicle maintenance supply bill, Senator Howe's sales and use tax exempting medical devices, the Ortman 529 tax incident study requirements modifying the study, Senator Benson's estate tax. She has two versions of that, and I will present them on her behalf if she's unavailable tomorrow. And her general fund checkoff. And on that bill, I have not been added as an author, but I'm trying to work through that on the Senate floor to make sure I can present her bill on her behalf. On Thursday, we have Senator Saxhog's Grand Rapids local option sales tax, Senator Gimsey's Glenwood Township minerals tax, Senator Rosen's Tobacco Uniformity Act, Senator Nelson's definition of a cigarette, Senator Rosen's personal property tax exemption for electric generating facilities, and Senator Sundrum's education tax credit. There may be other bills for Thursday that we may add to the agenda. We've got the hearing room or the room until 11 a.m., so we may extend on Thursday to accommodate other bills. Members, we are looking at hearings for next week, including Friday, the 25th. We definitely will have a hearing on the 25th, and we will take as long as necessary to process the committee's omnibus tax bill. So it will be rolled out on Wednesday. We will have public testimony on Thursday, and we will take amendments and proceed with final action on Friday, March 25th. Questions about the agenda? Otherwise, without further business, we are adjourned.